Okay, good morning. I'm David Rosberg from Niagara Capital. Welcome to what used to be a quarterly, but now maybe a little wobbly quarterly conference call with Al Friedberg, portfolio manager of the Global Macro Hedge Fund. Good morning, Al. How are you today?
Good morning, David. Well, yes, thank you.
Good. So, well, I start off by saying things have been a little bit wobbly in our calls, and the reason for that has been that, especially at the end of last year, not so much in the early part of this year, but especially, or not so much recently, but especially towards the end of last year, things were a bit wobbly in the performance, and I didn't want to press you because I know that you don't like to express a confidence that you don't really feel. You don't like to, as you said once, I think just prior to 2008, you don't like to make a track as though on cross-country skis that you get stuck in when what you really need is maneuverability and the flexibility to adjust things as they come clearer to you. Is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but before we go on, maybe I could just ask you
No,
if
that's
that's.
very well, that's very well put, David. Very well put. Yes,
Okay,
true. Very
good,
true.
good, good. Okay, again, then, just as a special kind of before we get to the actual portfolio, which is the traditional way that we orchestrate these calls, there have been changes made to the team, and perhaps not to the personnel, the same group there, but to the way the portfolio is managed, the way you're allocating responsibilities to the team members. And I thought that you might discuss that, like what it is, the changes that you've made and why you've made them.
Yes, we did write about it. I did write about it in the last few months. What I did is I brought in one of the members of my one of the members of my team of my really trading the execution team and part of the risk control team, Jamie, and he's Jamie McRae, and he's been actually writing part of the quarterlies, so I think the readers are familiar with him. So I brought him in as a co-manager into the fund. He's presently managing a small portion, somewhere around 20% of the fund, and I expect to be increasing his participation. He brings with him a slightly different style. Though our views remain basically the same, the macro views remain the same, and part of it is that it will remain as within my strategic view, but the tactics used are different. Jamie is more flexible. He has more of a trading attitude to some of these positions. He likes to move in and out more frequently than I do, and to take advantage of some of the large trading turns that some of our positions have. So I thought that that would be a very nice complement to the fund. I've been a little bit rigid in some of my positions, and maybe more dogmatic and that has come, as we saw last year, has come to the detriment of the fund. So I thought that that would be good. He also brings some new ideas. He actually did contribute to equity positions that have done very well. He's bought a group of as a group, a basket of tankers and a basket of coal miners and processors. Both of them have done extremely well, and so I'm very glad that new ideas are being introduced. So generally, I think that that combination is a good one, and I hope that that will continue to grow as the Jamie co-manages a larger portion of the fund and give the fund a little bit more, let's say a little bit more of a trading flavor in some cases.
How, what size of the, what size of the allocation now, and how big, how large are you, are you thinking to let it grow?
I think I mentioned that he has at the moment around 20%, and I'm looking to eventually get him up to somewhere between 33 and 40% of the fund. And you know, who knows, maybe more. But I mean, this is the current plan is somewhere between 33 and 40%.
I see. Okay. Okay, let's get now to talking about the actual portfolio. And I'm gonna start by dipping into the mailbag right from the get-go. One of the clients writes that we've been gratified to see that that your results don't exhibit a high degree of correlation with the stock market, and we assume that this is due to your low exposure to U.S. equities. Is this a deliberate policy or simply the result of not finding attractive enough opportunities in the U.S.? Before I hand that over to you, I mean, I think that it's very true that what we want is to have investments that are not correlated to stocks, but there are times when you don't want to be correlated. There are times when that's especially good, at times when they're not so good. And one of those times when it's not so good is when stocks happen to be the best performing asset class in the world, which is what's been the case with U.S. stocks. So how do you deal with that question, and how do you circle around that issue?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's true that sometimes the best place to be is that, and so you want to be correlated at times. The main problem, at least from my point of view, the main problem that I saw was that there aren't that many as we look through and analyze the behavior of the market. There haven't been that many sectors that have benefited from the current economic, let's call it recovery, or the post-pandemic recovery. It's been a fairly narrow market, narrow leadership. If you, for instance, if you look at the amount of 52-week new highs, we've never gone above 5% of stocks, of listed stocks. It's remarkable that this long into a bull market, we have had so few stocks making new 52-week highs. And sometimes as many stocks make new 52-week new highs as they make 52-week new lows. So it's a very narrow, very, very narrow advance. It is weighted heavily to the to stocks like everyone knows, part of the Magnificent Seven, now becoming Magnificent Four, but it's weighted towards Nvidia and Microsoft and Google and Amazon. Their large market caps influence market a great deal, and I believe that more than half, if not more than that, of the gains of the S&P, for instance, in the last 6, 7, 8 months have come from those stocks. So it is narrow. And because it is narrow, it also means that there's few opportunities unless you want to participate in those four stocks. We don't have much to say about them. We don't, at least me, I don't understand much the economics of AI. And I'm not very, let's call it tech savvy, and to understand any of these other companies. So I chose not to be involved with them. Instead, we keep looking around for sectors, and we do have companies in one sector. And in fact, over 40% of the we have a 40% exposure to the home builders. We think that that's a great industry. It is selling cheaply. These companies are very well capitalized today. There is an almost insatiable demand for housing. It cannot be satisfied yet because most people buy houses on credit, and mortgage rates are very high today. They're much higher than they were 2 years ago. But as soon as those mortgage rates come down, which they will, I think you will see a huge increase in new home sales. So there is an enormous gap. There's an enormous let's call it basically a shortage of homes as a percentage of the demographics in this country, in the U.S. That ever since 2010 or 2011, the industry has built far less homes than they should have built in line with the growth of the population. And we probably have a shortage of anywhere between 1 and 2 million homes. And we're pretty, I'm pretty certain and confident that as credit costs come down and mortgage rates come down, that there will be a demand for this, and that these companies and these builders, these public builders, will build more homes and make large profits. As it is now, they're selling at very, very reasonable multiples, much lower than the market multiples. And as I say, with demand guaranteed going forward, it's only a matter of now time and waiting until the interest rates come down, until the credit markets get a little more constructive for them. So we did find one group, and that's that. We're not very keen on any of the other major groups, although as I said before, Jamie found two groups that have very quietly climbed to new highs, tankers and coal miners, and they're continuing to do well, and they're probably going to be needed. I believe that this movement towards this whole movement towards greening and using solar power and wind power and so on, it's not going to be sufficient to power electricity in this country, and we're going to need very large amounts of electricity. Everybody agrees today for AI, and so there will be again a strong move into natural gas and coal, fossil fuels. So that's an interesting group. Those are two interesting groups. Tankers have benefited from the fact that there's been a not a great expansion, and actually there's been a lack of expansion in new tankers. And at the same time, the international conflicts around the Red Sea and other places have made the tariffs hold up better than expected. So they're doing well. They're doing very well there. So to answer your question, back to your question, we can't find too many interesting things. In fact, we found very few things to participate in. And so we stayed with the position that we have, which are not really equity oriented. One other exception is that we're very excited about the prospects for gold. We think that gold will continue to rise, and it will be the beneficiary of lower rates very soon.
Oh, Al,
But
let me introduce you. Let me interrupt you for just a sec before we get to that and circle back to home builders and the relationship to rates. Like, before we just toss out the idea that rates are going to go lower, in the case of home builders, you have a fundamental reason. You have this big macro reason, which is interest rates. But the interest rate view is critical to not just to the home builders, to your gold position, to equity multiples, even tankers and Jamie's coal producers. Interest rates are arguably the macro factor, and this is something that is fits squarely in your bailiwick. I cannot let you go on without asking you what your reasoning is for lower rates.
Okay. This is the macro view. This is the macro view, and this is built on the fact that I've been writing for now for the last 2, 3 years. We've had a very tight monetary policy Maybe actually unwittingly so. I don't think that the Fed has meant it in that sense, because I don't think the Fed measures it in that way. But we measure monetary policy not by rates, but by the amount of by the growth of money supply. And we had a huge increase in the growth of money supply in 2021, 2020, 21, 20, and early 22, and which gave rise to, in our view, which gave rise to that large spur of inflation, which has permanently, by the way, increased prices permanently. I mean, we're not talking about bringing prices down to correct for that increase. We're just saying we want to now slow down the pace to 2% a year less. But that huge bump, that huge increase in inflation that took place somewhere between 20 and 25% that took place over those 2 years, which is, by the way, the reason probably why the Biden administration is not getting credit for a strong economy and very low unemployment, is because the consumer has realized what has happened to prices. They have gone up and they've stayed up. And now they're rising only very slowly from here. So this phenomenon,
Especially the
which was
non-core items, especially the non-core items, the fuel and food. Sorry,
this no, it's okay, it's okay. But what I'm coming at is to say that since March of 22, we have had a very we have had a flattening of the growth of money supply, and it's now for almost 2.5 years. Let's say maybe 26 or 27 months, money supply has been flat, basically flat. And to me, what that means, that spells, first of all, stabilization of prices. Secondly, it may even spell a deflation of prices, that could still come. Depends how long we keep that monetary policy. And also, it does increase sharply the possibility of a recession. So having said that, and looking at what's happening to money supply, I believe that it's inevitable that we are moving into a much weaker economy. I believe that over the next 6 months or a year, whenever, we're going to see probably a substantial recession. I know that we've been looking at that for the past year or year and a half. But what we did not take into account, and this is true, we did not take into account the very large expansion of the fiscal deficit, and it was huge. And this increase in deficit spending has had an impact on economic activity and inflation too. So, from one side, from one point of view, money has not grown, and that is deflationary, or at least disinflationary. And the other point of, from the other side, fiscal policy has expanded so much that it has increased. In our view, what it meant is that velocity has increased, and because velocity increased, it made up for the paucity of money supply growth. So even that fiscal expansion is actually slowing down. So we will probably have a smaller deficit over the next 6 months or a year, a small deficit percentage of GDP. Between that and money being flat, we think that the conditions are there for the economy to go into recession. So when you're asking me, what do I think about rates? I think that rates will be going down. I think that the Fed will lower rates probably a little late, or probably a little bit behind where they should be. Again, for us, the rates are not important. For us, what's important is what effect will it have on money supply? And what we need in order to restart the economy, have the economy move back to a 3% rate of growth, let's say, sustainable 3% rate of growth, what we need is probably money to grow sustainably between 6 and 9% a year, and to between 6 and 9% a year. We're very far away from that. So, now, and I think you threw into the question, you threw the idea that, well, if rates are going to go down, then many things should be affected favorably, not just home builders. I think that that's probably what you meant,
Exactly.
right?
Exactly.
So my answer is no, doesn't have to be so. What I think what happens is if the Fed lowers rates in reaction to a recession, and it does like it did in 2008, which they started lowering rates, but the economy was going down. It does not have a positive effect on cyclicals. It does have a positive effect on home builders, because home builders have been typically for the past 50 or 75 years, typically have started going up during a recession. So home builders, I think, is somehow a little bit protected from that, but it does not have a bullish impact on cyclicals if the decline in rates is taking place because of recession. It's different if the decline in rates takes place because of a lower inflation or because of deflation. As long as the economy is doing well, it will be bullish for the cyclical stocks. But if the Fed is lowering rates because they're trying to counteract recessionary forces, and they're behind a little bit because they probably are just concentrating a lot on labor, and labor conditions are laggards in this kind of thing. I believe that that will not be bullish for the rest of the market. That will
Okay,
not be
so
bullish.
do you have a rate bet on, or do you regard the likely decline in rates to be a tailwind to other positions that you have, beginning with housing and including gold, which we can come to in a second?
Right. It is almost like an implicit position that we have, because it is very favorable for home builders, as you say, and it's very favorable for gold. That and therefore we're implicitly a short rate in that sense. We do have a small bet, a little small bet, a very small bet on SOFR, where we're risking very little money through an option mechanism, and expect the rates to come down. But the main play for us is that the lower rates, as rates go down, it will affect favorably those two main positions, and that's for us a very important development.
For people who don't know, just for their benefit, perhaps you could just talk a little bit of what SOFR is. It's a bit of a technical trade. It's not a common trade.
Well, it's like the old LIBOR. It's similar to the old LIBOR. It's like the interest rate, interbank interest rate, and it's calculated perhaps in a better way than it was before. Before, it was done via survey. Banks would tell you what rate they were charging, and it was prone to manipulation. And now it's done in a different way, and so it's probably more transparent. But what it basically is the interbank rate among the major banks in the world. It's a short-term rate, very short-term rate. It's very sensitive to Fed funds, very sensitive to news. You can actually trade it just like you trade any of the interest rate instruments. You can trade that one too.
Let's talk about gold.
Well, it is becoming more and more interesting, if only from a geopolitical situation. We have countries in the world that the US dollar dominance is slowly eroding. And one of the reasons it's eroding is not so much the fact that the US has a great capital market, which is still the best capital market in the world. One of the reasons it's eroding is because of sanctions. The US dollar today cannot be used in many places, and there are many things that are being sanctioned. And so its value on a global basis, its value for trading, for example, almost all the trading between Russia and China today is done not using the US dollar. Many people, millions of people around the world avoid the US dollar because they want to avoid the US banking system. And the reason that they want to avoid the US banking system is because of all kinds of regulations, know your customer regulations, regulations that deal with drugs, with a million other things that make the dollar not such a easy to use currency. And so the dollar is losing its dominance. I don't know for now, and I don't think there's anything in terms of currency that can take its place easily. Today, you still have 60% approximately of international reserves are held in dollars, about 60%, but it's coming down. It's been coming down. It's been coming down for the past decade. And probably will go down to 55 or 50%. But that's a threat to the monetary system. And there's only one quote unquote currency in some way that has history behind it, that has tradition behind it, that is safe from any kind of manipulation, and that's gold. And so slowly gold is coming back into the system, but what it needs to do in order to come back into the system is to get to a price that will make it easier to move the quantities of international reserves that today are held in currency, in dollars, for example, in euros. So at 2,500, what is that, 2,300, it's 2,400. It's still too low. It doesn't have enough gravity. It doesn't have enough gravitas. Not gravity. It doesn't have enough gravitas to be part of a monetary system. But at 5,000, it begins to look interesting. And at 10,000, it could be used as an important part of reserves and maybe the most important part of international reserves. And I believe that that's where we're going. I think that countries, even from a geopolitical point of view, many of the countries like have become hostile to the U.S. We have, we know China, we know North Korea, we know Russia, we know many other countries that want to get away from the U.S. from a political point of view, and they are accumulating gold. And so but as I say, it needs to get to a price level, and it will as they continue to buy, and as many central banks continue to buy. But it needs to get to a price level that can make it relevant for international reserves. And so we're moving in that direction. That's exactly what's happening. We're moving in that direction. And it's what's interesting. I just want to point this out. There's been very, very little speculative activity that we can see, at least in our markets, with regards to gold. If you look,
you mean in futures market,
at the futures market, for example, the open interest in the gold market, it's minimal. It's minimal compared to where it used to be. Whenever there was some kind of an event or something that gave people the worries about the future, and gold had a spike, open interest had gone up much higher than what it is today. It gives me confidence that there's been very little speculative activity. And the same thing is true with the ETF, right? We have a major ETF, which is GLD. The amount of units has been reducing for months and months and months. So again, it's not speculative buying. It's principally now central bank buying. Now, there are countries in the world where the public has been a buyer. But most of the time, they're buying it because it's easier. If they want to buy dollars and they're not able to buy dollars because of restrictions, they will buy gold as a way to get around buying dollars. But it is not a demand for gold necessarily, as it is a demand for dollars.
Okay.
And I believe that that's to come. And when that comes, I think that will be a very supportive factor for gold too.
Yep. The knock against gold has been, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, the knock against gold has always been that, as far as this particular argument goes, is that the size of the market is just too small relative to the dollar when thought of as a reserve currency to make it a serious consideration. Like any serious player who wanted to think of gold as an alternative to dollars, in order to accumulate a position, would have to the price would have to go up by 20 times. If that's true,
not 20,
and
not
you're
20.
arguing,
Yeah, not sorry, not 20. I think, as I said before, I think that if we got between 5 and 10,000 dollars an ounce, it would be probably sufficient. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I see. So then are you looking then as like, is the number some ratio between the dollar price, the dollar price times the number of ounces of gold relative to the US dollar reserve position? Is that, some kind
You
of
know what? You know what? It's a bit of a game. It's a bit of a game. It's very hard to calculate these things. But I would say that in the end, the major countries, and I'm talking the major 25, 30 countries in the world, the major economic countries, from an economic point of view, the major countries, if they would probably be satisfied, their central bank would probably be satisfied with a ratio of about 20 to 30% of their international reserves in gold. That's the number that I'm actually taking out of my hat. And one of the reasons I say that is, for example, the European countries, the ECB, I believe that started with like, I think that even today they have a 50% ratio of gold to international reserves, 50% of international reserves, meaning half of the international reserves are in gold at market prices. I don't know what the US is, but the US has a lot of gold in Fort Knox, so and it doesn't really have reserves in that sense. But if you go across the board, and for example, China, officially, they only have maybe a 4 or 5% exposure of gold in international reserves. That's very low, right? That's very low. If we went across the board and took countries like Brazil, which are large players, Hong Kong, Singapore, all these countries, and we said, okay, say 20 to 30% of the reserve, they will be satisfied with 20, 30% in gold. It means that the price has to rise substantially,
I see.
substantially,
I see.
and we have to move to that level. And once it moves to that level, what's funny and what's interesting is once it moves to that level, it becomes an important international reserve. It's not just that it goes up there, but at the point that gold is between $5,000 and $10,000, now it becomes real money. Now it's real money, and just think about it for yourself as an individual. You keep some gold. If gold was $2,000 an ounce, and you wanted to, I don't know, you wanted to move, run away from Uganda, and you wanted to go to London, and you wanted to take the gold with you, and you had $1 million, imagine how much gold you'd have to take with you in your suitcases, right? You would be sweating having to transport that amount. It's not a large enough number. But if it would be $10,000 an ounce, now it's interesting. Now it makes sense. Now you can take, you have enough gold to move around that has some relevance to world inflation, world economics, world money supply. You see what I mean? So it's not just
I
that the
do.
price will be rising to that level because they're buying, is that once it gets to that price, it becomes an interesting reserve asset. A really interesting reserve asset.
I hear. Okay, we have gold, we have housing, we have a position in tankers and in coal. We have a small position in the interbank borrowing rate SOFR. What else have we got? Is that it? That's it.
Maybe a very small percentage we had. We've been trading a few stocks, but it's not really very relevant. We had a couple of US stocks that are not belonging to that group, but quite not relevant at all. I would say that that covers 95% of what we have, about 95% of what we own.
Okay. All
Yeah,
right. Well
that's
then, I think that then covers it. Do you have any parting remarks? Any closing remarks?
well, we are always looking to get into some interesting markets that are not that have not been yet discovered, right? That have not been yet discovered. And by the way, we still own a very small, very just to remind you, we still own a very small We have very small exposure to cannabis stocks, U.S. cannabis companies, not Canadian ones. They are listed in some of them listed in Canada, some are listed over the counter, and the reason we have them is because we've been waiting for it to become to that we've been waiting for the prohibition to be lifted, and there are some small steps that we've seen going in that direction now. These companies have they can't even open bank accounts. There was some of these companies that we have are well run, but they can't even open bank accounts because of this federal prohibition. Some of the states have now allowed it, and it's become easier to operate. But and now they made some new steps that have taken probably taken some new steps that will allow them to treat their profits in a better than they used to. Them they were taxed at a very high rate, but we have, I think, our exposure around 2.5% of portfolio. We believe that when the prohibition is finally lifted, which could take a little while still, they could rise in maybe 200 to 300%. So that's a very minor position, but I mentioned it because that's in that miscellaneous group that I was actually telling about. But in looking for new positions, in looking for new ideas, one of the things that we're looking at is platinum, because platinum is mined in South Africa, and South Africa has become a basket case, a real economic basket case. Problems with energy, problems with labor, and South Africa is the major producer of platinum. So we think that it's only a matter of time before we see a substantial rise in the price of platinum. So we're always looking for some special opportunity in the commodity markets, because commodity markets, and I need to say this because I think it's going to become ever more important in the next few years. The world is having supply problems. It's not so much the demand side, it's the supply side. Restrictions, regulations, all these things are affecting the supply of commodities. And we know many, many mines, for example, that have not been able to open for years because of restrictions, because of legal restrictions, because of regulation. And whether you believe they're right or wrong, but the fact is that we've had problems there. And we've had problems in supply in almost every single commodity. So we have to pay attention to the supply side more even than the demand side, right? Supply side is extremely important. And if, for instance, they don't allow you, if tomorrow the administration, U.S. administration decides that we cannot do any more fracking, you can imagine what will happen to the price of natural gas, for example, where we are major producers and we're trading now at an extremely low price, right? So it's supply restrictions that will actually rule the prices, commodity prices, and we are very attentive to them. And I think that there's going to be some very interesting possibilities.
Well, I was ready to say goodbye, but I just want, now that you've opened the box of commodities, there are
Pandora,
two things.
Pandora, Pandora.
The Pandora's box. There are two things to talk about. One is, I know that you've been very sensitive to, or you've looked at commodities as a very sensitive index to future inflation. And the other is that we've had very volatile commodity markets in two in particular that when you and I first met, you traded very actively, and I'm talking, of course, about copper and cocoa. What are commodities telling you about how are commodities confirming or not confirming your thesis that money supply is causing a slowdown in economic activity generally and is going to lead to lower rates?
Good question. That's a good question. And that's why the supply problem is something to consider. Commodity prices have basically bottomed for the past 6 months. They've come off a little, they've come off the bottom a little bit, but they're still sitting pretty close to the bottom after a very long decline. But from time to time, you have a problem in copper, for example, where we saw a huge run up, and now it's coming back down, but we saw a very large run up. You have had commodities that, even oil, for example, had a very large run-up because of, let's say, war conditions or because of restrictions in the movement of tankers. But it's these kind of supply problems that appear in commodities. For example, orange juice. Just to give an example, a funny example, because that was the last time I traded orange juice was 1974, I think. That goes a long way. That's almost 50 years ago. And I was shocked the other day to look and see. I remember trading it when it was a dollar, $1.20, and I looked at it the other day, and it was $5. And it's been going up steadily. It increased 400%. But the reason it's gone up so much is because there's been an infestation that's killing all the trees. All the trees in Florida are being killed, and now the infestation has gotten to Brazil. So it's so bad that I understand that the big juice makers are considering mixing the orange juice with the oranges with mandarins, for example, because they won't have enough juice to make. And so here's another supply problem, right? This one may be not necessarily the fault of human beings, or maybe it is. Maybe they should have used something to control this infestation. But here's a situation where the supply has been devastated, devastated, right? And that's holding up the overall price level. So if I want to look at the Bloomberg Commodity Index and say, what is it telling me now about coming 12 months? What is it telling me now about inflation and about economic activity? I have to be a little bit more careful now because there's too many supply problems appearing that can distort the picture. But having said that, we still have not really come off the bottom by more than 2-3%, maybe 4%. It's a very small amount, but we're watching it. That's a very important indicator. Yes.
Okay, let's treat that as an epilogue to this quarter's conversation, and end by again, as we do every quarter, wishing you the best of luck with the portfolio and with the construction of new ideas and with Jamie's participation in the portfolio. Hope all goes well.
Good. Thank you, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's have a great quarter. Bye bye.
Let's have a great quarter. Bye bye.